This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Things have gone to hell again on the COVID front.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at FordhamInstitute.org. Now, please welcome my special guest for this week, John Bailey. John, welcome back to the show.
Oh my gosh, it's so good to be back with you, Mike.
Yeah, we enjoy having you here, John. But you know that if you're back, it only means one thing. Things have gone to hell again on the COVID front. John, yeah. For those of you that somehow don't know, he is a non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He also has a Substack that comes out daily with just jam-packed of information on COVID and schools. You know, this is an interest of John's going back to his days in the George W. Bush administration when you helped to develop a playbook on pandemic response. And little did you know that would be the part of that administration's experience or one key part that you would be dealing with all these years later. Maybe you did know. I don't know. Maybe it scared the hell out of you back then and you knew this was coming.
Yeah, it scared me, which was like fascinating. But also, you know, it was interesting how much we had planned on a virus that's very different than what COVID has given us. And so,
well, last time we had John here, I think we were getting ready for the Delta wave, or we were dealing with that as we were looking to back to school. Well, here we are now, early 2022, and Omicron is among us. As our listeners know, John, my boys and I had it over the holidays. We're fine. Thank you. Mild case. Feels like everybody we knew in our neighborhood, really in DC, seemed to get it over the holidays. I mean, it is no joke. And it's, of course, wreaking havoc out there in the schools. We are going to talk about all of that in Ed Reform Update. And I should say, John, my co-host David is not with us today because he himself is dealing with an Omicron outbreak at his son's preschool. They shut it down because somebody tested positive. So, where to begin? How are you feeling right now, John, about how schools are coping with this? It looks like mostly they are staying open for in-person instruction, except for a couple of big school, urban school systems. But you hear stories of chaos, of tons of kids out on quarantine, teachers out on quarantine, staff out on quarantine. Have we now gone too far in the other direction of keeping schools open at all costs? What's your sense?
Well, I think it's mixed. I mean, first, the good news, what you were just sort of alluding to, which is the fact that most schools are open. Like, that's something that should be celebrated and acknowledged, that, you know, the experiences of what's going on with the Chicago's teachers union, it's isolated. The one challenge that we saw actually during the fall, and I think has become sort of the main issue so far in January, has been quarantines. And here we don't have official data. Again, I can't believe we're this far into the pandemic and the U.S. Department of Education or the CDC isn't requiring this data to be reported, not collecting it. So we don't know how many kids were in quarantine. We have some surveys that suggest one in three parents said that their kids were in a quarantine during the fall. That's a huge number of kids out of school for up to 2 weeks. And here, that seems to be what's triggering a lot of school closures, is that you have, Mike, as you were just alluding to, you have a teacher, faculty member, a school bus driver, or a kid who tests positive. And then that automatically triggers a 5-day isolation period and a quarantine for anywhere up to 5 to 10 days for kids. And so that has really disrupted a lot of school operations. Schools that have wanted to stay open just don't have the staff to stay open. And so that's been a challenge. It has also been a challenge because the CDC has been all over the place with their isolation and quarantine guidance, literally changing it 3 or 4 times over the holiday break. And so I'm very sympathetic to schools here because, you know, if they're given kind of clear and simple roadmaps to follow, you know, most schools can do that. They've not been given clear and simple roadmaps to follow when it comes to quarantine and isolation.
No, that's right. And even the sort of 5 days versus 10 days, there was a few days there where there was a debate about what the CDC had actually said. I mean, we could all read it, but it was like we were interpreting the Talmud. I mean, we were like playing interpretation here, because it was so unclear. Like, did this apply to schools? Did this not apply to schools? Can you go shorter? Can you not go shorter? What if they're asymptomatic? Does that matter? Vaccinated? Does that matter?
And did it require a test or not? The CDC has been back and forth on that. And I just went back on prepping for the podcast today just to double check something in my head on this. And the CDC guidance had changed again over the last couple. And so they're encouraging a test, but not requiring a test. And that's very different than what you have with with workers, and it's very different than what they're requiring for healthcare workers too.
Yep. Yep. And of course, part of that is that these tests are still in short supply, right? So here we are. All right. So John, as always, I try to say, you know, give us some good news. So as you look into your crystal ball, well, first of all, it does sound like everybody expects Omicron to come in fast and furious and then leave again pretty quickly, right? So this wave is, even in some parts of the Northeast, we think maybe has already peaked and is, we're coming back down on the other side of it. As it rolls throughout the country, hopefully it'll be short-lived, especially the severe impacts on hospitals and such. And then the big question is, can we just decide that we're done? That, you know, it's become endemic instead of a pandemic, that there's enough immunity out there, and, you know, at least fingers crossed that we don't get another terrible variant, but that we can just say, all right, this is enough. It's been 2 years. We're going back to normal.
Yeah. I mean, I think there could be some good news with a pinch of bad news. The good news is that, you know, maybe Omicron, it helps accelerate the transition to an endemic, where this is something that's a nuisance. It's something you deal with. Much the same way we deal with other respiratory infections throughout the year. And so hopefully this accelerates that. In fact, you know, I think, you know, last time we were on the podcast, we talked a little bit about, there was some discussion about this, even with that last Delta wave, that there was a decoupling between cases and also hospitalizations and deaths. And we started seeing that a little bit with Delta. It's very much there with Omicron, that as much as you're seeing these soaring case rates going up, you're not seeing nearly the same sort of level of hospitalizations or deaths. Now you see more people going to the hospital, but it's a little bit different just because of just how enormously infectious Omicron has been. So maybe that accelerates, and that natural immunity, it seems like, again, it's been a modern medical miracle to have the vaccines as effective as what they have and as durable against some of these other variants that have emerged. So that's the good news. One bad news, which is, I think what we keep sort of experiencing, is that we keep thinking if we get past this wave, we can get back to normal. And then Delta sort of caught schools flat-footed back in September and August. Omicron caught the federal government and a lot of us flat-footed. And so I worry that we hopefully can get to this endemic phase, but we really need better plans and preparations for if another variant comes out. Now, hopefully we never need to invoke those plans or use those plans. But I feel like what happens is every single time we keep thinking we've moved on, and then COVID surprises us with a new variant. And then we're very much in a situation right now where the federal government's scrambling to get tests. But by the time they get the tests out to schools, Mike, to your point, like, it's going to mostly have burned through most of the country. And so we're just not moving and adapting fast enough. And I think this is a warning sign for us to hopefully have better plans and preparations should they be needed. Hopefully they don't. But we should make sure that there's better preparations next time.
Yeah, no, that all makes sense for sure. But it is fair to say that this decision about, you know, whether we're ready to transition back to something that's much more like normal, I mean, is this a scientific discussion or this is kind of a political choice, right? I mean, we kind of say like, well, you know, everybody who wants a vaccine has got the opportunity to get one. And, you know, we're going to keep, I'm sure there's going to be more boosters. There's going to be more, you know, ways to protect people. But at some point you decide, you know, there's a trade-off on all of these mitigation. And it's just been especially bad for the nation's children, you know, mentally, socially, academically, and we just can't take it anymore.
No, I think you're right. I mean, first of all, policy and politics is always about weighing trade-offs. And maybe this does tip the equation. I mean, the other thing is that we just have more tools. You were pointing to the vaccines. Those are incredibly effective tool. We also have therapeutics. Those were not available a couple of months ago. And so get us another tool that if you get COVID and if it's a really bad case, we now have some medicine that can actually help working its way through the approval system with both Pfizer as well as Merck. That's hugely positive. And so maybe this does. And it's interesting, Mike. Like, I remember I asked two former very, very senior officials from the Obama administration who have been advising the Biden administration on how do we know when we've moved from a pandemic to an endemic. And even they admitted they don't know entirely. That's a little bit psychological. It's psychological as a country, is where they are, what they're willing to tolerate. And if anything, like, I think you saw that over break where people are just ready for this to become an endemic and willing to take some risks. I think it's accelerated that group a little bit.
Well, and you start to think about like, what does this look like for schools? I mean, you know, what's the first thing to go? Like, okay, do we stop trying to do the surveillance testing? Does the quarantine policy change? It basically says, if you feel sick, stay home and don't get other people sick, but otherwise go to school, teachers and students. And right. Is that the other thing? You know, of course the masking debate is going to come on. I mean, that this is what it would mean. You know, we're going to keep schools open. We're not going to cancel sports. We're not going to cancel stuff, right? This is what it's going to look like.
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, I wish we were having a better conversation about this, because I feel like this, it's how you teed up even this conversation earlier, is that you have two sides that become super polarized. It's everything else in society right now. You have a team that doesn't wants to see more restrictions. They want schools shut down because this is mm-hmm. like proving out the point that hospitals are overwhelmed. If there's ever a time to flatten a curve, now is the time to do it. So you have that. You have another side that's like, look, this is mild. This is just like the flu. And so we shouldn't be trying to slow it down. We should just be removing some of these restrictions and letting it work its way through the system. And vaccines provide some protections. And by the way, we can help treat people if they're, and I think we need to be having a healthier conversation about what does a transition period look like? Like, if you have more vaccinations in a school, can you remove some of these restrictions? Like, mm-hmm. what are the off-ramps? What are the exit strategies? Mm-hmm. And we have not had a great conversation about that. Like, and I think it's part of the problem of like, you know, if kids are infectious and they should stay home, well, then that creates some challenges that what if they're asymptomatic and still mm-hmm. infectious? And these are like tensions that I think people are having a hard time sort of like holding in tension mm-hmm. to some degree. But it's also a time when we need, coming back, clear and simpler guidance from the CDC. And we're not getting it, getting more muddled. It's making it more confusing.
Yep. But it does sound like if you're an educator out there, especially an educational leader, superintendent, you head of charter management network, state superintendent, I mean, you got to be thinking through these issues that whatever CDC does, and let's hope they get better at this, you know, that you can think about these off-ramps yourselves, you know, and how to lead that conversation about what's safe. You know, what are the indicators? Maybe case loads don't make sense anymore as the main indicator, hospitalizations do. So, you know, if the Omicron wave crests, it goes away, hospitalizations come down, at least in the spring, we're in a good place, maybe, you know, what are some of those things we can start to peel off? And what are the things that we should stick with maybe, you know, a little bit longer? Yeah, you're right. I don't hear people having that conversation, but we're starting it here, baby, on the Education Gadfly Show.
No, and also like, you know, where is the, let's run some experiments on this, right? Like, again, if we were collecting data, we'd be able to say, okay, the schools that have been relaxing their mask mandates, relaxing their distancing, like what was the impact on that? But again, like in a weird way, we're making all these decisions blind because we're just not collecting the data. But you're absolutely right. Like governors are empowered here. CDC, it's just guidance. It's just guidelines. They don't, these are not mandates. And I'm already seeing a lot of states coming up and using this as like a moment to come up with their own sort of guidance going forward.
Yeah. And I hear your dog Bentley agrees with you. So
he's got all sorts of opinions on this stuff.
Well,
I apologize for the barking.
Yeah, he's well informed. All right, John. Hey, we always appreciate you coming on. You did give us some glimpses into the future that maybe don't look so bad, but it's been 2 years, hasn't it? We really got to get better at this.
Can I come back on your show and talk about something else?
Yes. Yes, I promise. Yes. Yes. Awesome. Let's do that. All right. John Bailey, again, non-resident senior fellow at AEI. Thanks so much for coming on the show, John.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
All right. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Oh, my goodness. Are we ready to have this whole Omicron thing done with yet?
Oh, man. It is. It's tough. And then let's just put the snow forecast on top of that. It'll really do you in.
Yeah. No, I know. Although, look, we like to ski and snowboard and such. So.
Right. I like to hibernate.
And in fact, I shouldn't really, you know, say this publicly, but, you know, given that I'm supposed to be an education, quote, expert and all that. But, you know, the Montgomery County added 3 half days to the calendar that was really supposed to be to help deal with teacher mental health days. Huh. So we decided that Nico the other day could skip one of those half days and go skiing with his friends. Which helps his mental health. It was actually a great decision.
Good deal.
There you go. So enough about that. What you got for us this week?
I have a new study that documents how employers view the skills inherent in college majors via online ads that they post for job openings. I just like these kind of studies where they just, you know, use online ads to collect data about what we think employers want to see. It also looks at how skills are similar across majors and how differences in skills profiles explain differences in wages. And then at the end, it sort of, which may be sort of a little more relevant to our world, it touches on the need for articulating better how skill sets differ across majors so that workers can better meet the local needs of employers. Analysts measure the skills that employers associate with particular majors using job vacancy data obtained from Burning Glass Technologies. I think we know about this company. They collect basically the near universe of all job ads in order to develop some labor market analytic products. But good for us, we also get to use their data, even as they're using all this data to develop nifty products. Their data include information not only on majors, but on skills, locations, and occupational data, which enable researchers to link skills and majors together at the individual job level and account for within occupation variation and skill demand, which may be correlated with college major. The data precedes the employment choices of workers, so it's independent of occupational sorting. Their final sample includes online ads from 2010 through 2018. It focuses on ads that require a bachelor's degree and list at least one skill in one major, which leaves them with about 18.5 million unique job ads. They use the Classification of Instructional Programs, or CIP, which is apparently pretty widespread, to code majors into broader categories. It's mostly descriptive. I'll have a little fun with you guys. We'll play a little quiz here.
Oh, man.
On the descriptive front, five majors appear in at least 10% of postings. One of them is business. Want to try to guess maybe the second most popular one of majors in at least 10% of online postings?
You took the one I was going to go for.
let's say econ.
Nope.
Yeah.
But econ's going to come up later. So
that's how you make money, but how many people actually do?
Engineering.
Nope. Sort of related, though.
I want to say communications, but that's more like what people get. It's not what people ask for.
All right. You guys are done. Computer.
Computers.
Computers and informational sciences. Yeah, I think our producer knew that one. He's giving me the thumbs up. All right.
Are computers still a thing?
You get a second chance to redeem yourself.
Please, no.
The least frequently demanded majors. Now we're on the other end.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The ones that hardly appear, ever in online ads.
Oh, man.
Oh, we got fun with this. Philosophy.
You got it, Mike. Philosophy and religion is one of them. There's mm-hmm. other. Anybody else? David, you want to take a stab?
I mean, English, right? That's stereotypically. No?
It didn't make it. Thank you. I'm an English major.
Okay. Well, then the whole musical is based on a lie then, but okay.
Sociology.
I was going to say ethnic studies. I don't even know what you want to call it. Like,
no.
What is it?
It's library science, right? Should have thought of that one. Library science.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Kind of going by the wayside, apparently. Visual and performing arts.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay, sorry.
Atmospheric sciences. Not sure why that one ended up there, but anyhow.
And Amber, what were some of the other ones that were at the top of the list? Business.
Let's see. Business, computer, informational sciences. I don't have the top. Sorry, I just put two in my research minute.
Okay.
Next, they look at whether the distribution of majors maps to the distribution of degrees granted. And they find that nursing and economics have demand that's proportional to the number of degrees awarded. So that's mm-hmm. good news. However, engineering and statistics majors are overrepresented to degrees mm-hmm. granted. Philosophy and religion and English are underrepresented. So we see a disconnect between supply and demand for these various majors. Next, they look at skills and find that a bucket of what they term cognitive skills, problem solving, critical thinking skills, those types of things, are listed in more than 3/4 of all job ads. In contrast, people management, supervising and directing people, for instance, and writing skills are the least likely to appear in these ads. I was thinking, clearly, these are not Fordham ads.
No.
Got to know how to write to work here. But anyhow, then they drill down into the majors and the skill sets again, bunch of various findings, but I just plucked out a couple here. Nearly all jobs in computer science desire specific software skills. That makes sense. Most majors also, other than this cognitive skills, require social and organizational skills. Mm-hmm. Want people to be super detailed and organized. Business and economics majors are also associated with skills that are demanded in a large variety of jobs, whereas nursing and foreign language majors are more specialized. Makes sense. And teacher education was a more specialized major as well. I think it ended up in that top bunch. Finally, they look at average earnings by major across MSAs, including those folks who are 25 to 54 with bachelor's degrees using data from the American Community Survey. They find substantial geographic variation both across and within majors in mean hourly wages. After accounting for major and geographic location, there's still variation in the demand for particular skills. However, that remaining variation does not correlate well with variation in earnings. They don't seem to trust that finding. And they basically, they've got a section of the paper that leads them to believe that we need more fine-grained categorization of skills that could better explain the wage variation within major and across places, which could then inform better pathways for colleges to use in differentiating what skill sets are needed for particular majors. I don't think they like this CIP thing that I mentioned earlier in a way to better meet local employment demand. So I think their bottom line was, we still aren't doing a great job trying to categorize some of these skills, especially some of these more specialized skills in these various majors.
This is great. And we've done some work on this too, which we'd love to talk about. We looked at college wage premium across states. You know, but and certainly this is all about giving good advice to young people about saying, hey, if you care about making money, some of these majors have a better chance of getting a job or a good paying job than others. I just always wonder if that matters, though, you know, because on the other hand, people are like, look, I'm good at what I'm good at, and I'm just not interested or good at the stuff that you need to be a computer engineer, for example. You know, I'm more of a philosophy person. I don't know. What do we do about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of the returns to education aren't pecuniary, right? They're about broader sort of life satisfaction, Mike. I don't know what we do about that.
Oh, is that right?
We like to think so. We like to think so. There's a great paper on that. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, hey, it's true. In my case, that I get to root for Michigan every year when they're having a good football season. That is a great return to my college education.
Right? I mean, your parents are, Mike, I guess you're telling your kids whatever's going to make you happy. Your kids are still too young to be thinking about college. But I mean, are we really still telling kids that? But, you know, if you want to major in philosophy or whatever,
you happy. I think there's different ways. There's this argument that says, hey, you know, get a liberal arts degree and, you know, because that's the best way to give a broad education and explore your strengths. And then, you know, yes, you're going to have to go to graduate school or something later. I buy that to some degree. But the point I'm more making, Amber, is that, you know, we are all born with certain talents and, you know, certain strengths and weaknesses. And those get developed as we get older. But I just don't think that when you're 18, you're not a blank canvas. You know, you can't just decide, oh, I see on a report that computer engineers make a ton of money, and therefore I'm going to choose to be a computer engineer. If that's not where your strengths lie, that's probably not going to work out very well, right? Which is not to say that there's not some, you know,
training.
Or that within some boundaries. I mean, maybe if you're more somebody who loves to write and think big ideas, you know, you say, all right, well, there's, you know, 5 or 6 different majors I could go to, and maybe there's a few that are smarter to choose than others, right?
Let me ask this question. Do we think that the market is going to sort this out? In other words, like, do we think that I had no idea of any of this stuff when I was 18, right? So the question is how any of it gets aligned at all. I mean, schools incentives, you know, they aren't to align, right? At some level, it's sort of mysterious, right, to me that any of this winds up getting aligned at any level because the schools don't care. They care about, you know, getting your money and give you an English major. And the kids have sort of a dim sense of it.
But we do see patterns over time. I mean, my sense is that we have seen kids gravitate, for example, away from English. I mean, there's this crisis in the English major. People talk about this. Now, is that because they have heard that you can't get a good job with an English degree? Is it because the English departments have gone super woke? You know, all of the above? I don't know. But there are changes over time. So, you know, something's happening. The young people are responding to some kind of signals. Course, we talked about recently, you know, that sometimes colleges do, they they limit the number of kids that can go into a particular major. They have some control over these things as well. But right. But no, I don't know. I mean, maybe it doesn't work for 18-year-olds, but maybe it does work for 30-year-olds. You know, at some point people are out there and they're like, okay, time for me to get a decent job. I want to start a family. I want to buy a house and I'm going to suck it up and, you know, do something that maybe is not my dream job, or I didn't think it was my dream job when I was 12, but I could
bring
do it.
Some of the bacon,
I could do it right. Well enough. And it's something that's in demand.
Yeah. And there's training though, too. I don't have to go back for a 2 or 4 year degree. You know, we talk about these other, whatever, technical college or something. You take a couple courses that you can, you know, gain a marketable skill. So that those types of programs still exist is important for that sort of hypothetical 30-year-old.
Yeah. I'm also wondering how much my own experience is coloring the way I think about this, right? As I'm thinking about it some more, your typical college student takes, you know, may take 5 or 6 years, right? Bounce in and out of the labor market. I think maybe there is more of a sort of ongoing signaling going on as you're moving through college than we might assume. People are trying to make it happen. So anyway, it's interesting. I don't know if more fine-grained data is the answer, as I guess where I was driving with this, right? It may simply be that we can let people do their thing.
Yeah. Hey, one more point. In defense of writing skills, I got to say, they say they care about critical thinking skills. There's no better way to figure out if somebody has strong critical thinking skills than whether they can write. Can't write well if you don't think clearly.
All right. And can put together an argument.
We all learned that from Checker Finn himself.
That's great to say. And how all to right. develop a good metaphor. Although I still don't think I've learned that from him. My metaphors are still just pitiful.
Yeah, my goodness. Oof. All right, Amber. Great stuff. Thank you so much. That is all the time that we have, though. So until next week.
I'm David Griffin.
And I'm Mike Petrilli, the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.